This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. The Declaration of Independence is a unique document that makes the pursuit of happiness one of the country's inalienable rights. Economists have wrestled with the question about whether wealth makes a person or even a nation happier. Economist Richard Easterlin, published an influential paper back in the 1970s that argued that when a country became richer, that didn't make people happier once their basic needs were taken care of. This Easterlin paradox, as it is known, has been called into question by a number of economists, including our guests. Betsy Stevenson is assistant professor of business and public policy at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Justin Wolvers is associate professor of business and public policy at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, both of them joining us today on Radio Times. Their research looks at money and happiness, and they found some interesting connections, and unlike Easterlin, say that rich people in countries are more satisfied than poor people in poor countries, and they join us today on Radio Times to talk about their research and their findings. Nice to have you with us. Good morning.
Great to be here.
Morning, Maddie.
Let me begin with you, if I could, Justin Wolfers, and I don't want to have too many definitions on the table, but I want to know how economists define happiness. When economists talk about happiness, what do they mean?
Empirical economists have to define happiness simply in terms of how we can measure it, and the current most widespread measurements are: you go out in the field and you ask people questions. Taking all things together, how happy would you say you are? Very happy, pretty happy, not too happy. Psychologists have taken a bunch of different approaches to measurement. Things like looking at how often people smile, whether other people say you're happy. You can measure activity in different parts of the brain, and it turns out that those more objective measures of happiness correlate pretty highly with how people respond on these happiness questionnaires.
So you're saying people actually know how happy they are?
They seem to respond in a way that's consistent with some of the other physical symptoms, yeah.
You want to add to that?
One of the reasons why these questions are typically about happiness or life satisfaction have been used is because those are the questions that have appeared in the data for decades. And so we can actually see how answers to those have trended and changed over time. But we're actually starting to gather some new data on questions that ask about affect, more specifically asking about pain or smiling or depression or even did you have good tasting food to eat?
Right.
And so one of the things we do in this paper is we start with what everyone else has been doing, looking at life satisfaction or happiness, but we end by looking at some of these other more very specific measures of how you experience your life.
But I wonder too, because I would think that people can have different definitions of what makes them happy. I mean, for some, they're happy that they can buy stuff. I mean, if they have money, it's fun to buy stuff. Or they have access to experiences that enhance their life. They feel a kind of social connection. They feel like they have friends and family that support them in the world. That often leads to a kind of satisfaction or happiness. I mean, the American dream in many ways is tied into this notion of happiness and be able to make something better for the people that come after you. Do you factor that kind of stuff in?
I think indirectly, yes. Our job isn't to judge what should or shouldn't make you happy. Simply, are you happy?
Right.
And we're going to let the survey respondents be the best judge of that. If they tell us they're happy, we're going to take it as being they're happy.
Right. So take us into your research then, and why you wanted to look at, I guess, economics and happiness. And I'm back to you, Betsy.
Well, we wanted to come back to this Easterlin question, which is, does income actually make people happier? It's a very important question for economists because we spend a lot of time trying to increase economic growth, trying to expand the wealth of our societies. And if all of that is for naught, if people aren't being made happier, then perhaps we are not doing what's in the best interest of society. And when we turned back and looked at the question, what we found was not a definitive answer, money doesn't make us happier. We found that back when Richard Easterlin started looking at this question, there just wasn't enough data to know the answer. And there's a very big difference between we just don't know and money doesn't make us happier. And we wanted to distinguish between those.
And just going back to that research, which I summarized probably much too briefly in my introduction, which is he took a look at this and said, you know, once those basic needs are taken care of in a country, there isn't a dramatic difference between having more money and being happier.
Yeah, so this is absolutely a measurement question. And the Easterlin paradox, as it was originally stated, was three empirical claims. In any given country at any point in time, rich people look like they're happier than poor people, but it didn't look like rich countries were happier than poor countries, and it didn't look like as countries got richer that they got poorer. Revisiting the data, we find the first...
Which I mean got happier.
Sorry, they didn't get happier.
Right.
And all of that then invites the inference, if that were true, then maybe what really matters is being richer than the Joneses. And that's why...
Relative richness.
Yeah, absolutely. In which case, economic growth makes us all richer, that therefore makes none of us happier. It turns out if you go back to the data, rich people are happier than poor people. But it's also overwhelmingly true with these new large cross-country data sets. We have 132 countries that rich countries are much happier, much, much happier than poor countries.
And when you say rich, I mean, and obviously we're talking about countries here. So when you add all the people up, more people are happier in a rich country.
Absolutely. Yes. And a very, very high correlation, suggesting that one of the most powerful ways of raising happiness in a society seems to be associated with levels of economic development.
So does that make the United States is the richest country in the world? I mean, allegedly.
We're certainly right up there.
It depends on the oil price. So how happy? I mean, are we the happiest country in the world if we're the richest country in the world? Can you say that?
Typically, the Danes are right up there, actually.
The Danes are.
But they're, again, in the League of Nations, extraordinarily wealthy. So the U.S. is about as happy as you would expect us to be, given our level of wealth. There are a couple that are a little happier than you might expect them to be, and a couple who are a little sadder. But, you know, we're pretty much right up there.
Do you want to add to that? I mean, and I guess... you know, look, for instance, why the Danes seem to be a little bit happier than other people?
Well, we don't really, you know, let me see if I can say this without getting too much into statistics, but what we see is a very strong correlation between a nation's income and aggregate happiness. But that correlation isn't one for one.
Right.
In other words, what we have are some countries that seem to be a little bit too happy given their income and some countries that are a little bit too sad given their income. And we don't really know what it is that makes the countries who are, you know, who are happier than they should be happier than they should be, and we don't know what makes the countries that are less happy. One thing that was interesting to me when I looked at the data is that it does seem like the Scandinavian countries which have much higher levels of public goods seem to be a little bit happier than they should be given their income. And I think that's an open research question whether that public goods associated with their style of government is contributing to that.
Well, let me just pick up on that. I'll toss this back to you. I mean, looking at the United States, yes, there's a lot of money. We've got this expanding GDP, but we also have growing disparities, economic income disparities in this country.
Absolutely. And actually, one of the biggest puzzles in the data is why the U.S. hasn't gotten happier over the last 30 years. It turns out as Japan has developed economically over the last four decades, it's gotten a lot happier. As Europe has gotten richer, it's gotten a lot happier. And it's actually been true for most other countries. The U.S. is one of the very few countries where happiness hasn't grown. When we talk about a statistic like GDP per capita, that's a statement about what is the income of the average person. Now, it could be that the average doesn't look like many of us. And if instead you look at something like median incomes, median incomes haven't actually grown by very much in the U.S. And particularly, median incomes are actually lower today than they were 7 years ago. And so if most of us aren't getting the benefits of economic growth, then perhaps it's not so surprising that happiness isn't growing in the U.S.
Would that describe the U.S. then, you think? But I mean, looking at some of these figures, but looking at this notion of happiness, is that people haven't felt the benefits of this growing economy.
Absolutely. I mean, on the one hand, you can simply look at the income data, and the income data tell us that very few people have enjoyed most of the benefits, and most of us have enjoyed very few benefits. Given that, it's probably not surprising that very few of us are becoming happier.
Well, and I don't want to get too deep in here, but nonetheless, there was an interesting piece in the New York Times on Sunday speaking to some of the things that we're talking about here, but raising questions about the GDP as a way of evaluating, first of all, a country's growth and then trying to associate that with happiness. And I'll just quote here, it measures wealth, this would be the GDP, just fine, but as a stand-in gauge for the nation's overall well-being, this super number, the GDP, is less than perfect and goes on to describe why. You think there's some truth to that?
Absolutely. There's a famous Bobby Kennedy speech in which Kennedy talked about how whenever we lock up a criminal, that adds to a GDP. When we knock down our forests, that adds to GDP. When a mother stops looking after her child and becomes a childcare worker looking after the neighbour's child, that adds to GDP. So there's certainly a lot of reasons why we might think GDP is a very imperfect measure. That said,
Okay.
The empirical statement that I want to make is, across countries, levels of GDP explain a heck of a lot about levels of happiness, suggesting that maybe those countries with low levels of GDP also have, perhaps, you know, more crime or more environmental degradation and all these other things that Kennedy was concerned about may also sometimes be a consequence of low levels of economic development.
But does it also say maybe there's something sort of aberrant or unique about the United States when looking at GDP, happiness, all of that?
You know, I find it hard to believe that the United States is one of the few countries in the world where we don't get happier with more money. It just seems almost counter to our culture that we would be immune to the benefits of money. I think one of the reasons people have a hard time thinking about this relationship between income and happiness is what we're not saying is everybody should go out and earn as much money as they absolutely can and forsake everything else in their life. We are not saying that. What we are saying is that on average, when you see that people earn more, they're happier. Richer people are happier than poorer people within countries, across countries, and over time in most countries, right, except for the U.S. But that's also associated with having more capabilities, more opportunities to earn money. So it's not that we think the person who chooses all the high-earning opportunities is the happiest person, but it's the person who has the most opportunities that we think is happier. And when we look in the data, it just happens to be that this high rate of opportunities, right, is correlated with high income.
But that raises public policy questions, does it not, about creating opportunity for people so that they can take advantage of these opportunities?
Right, that's exactly right. So one of the most important things is to think about education, because education creates opportunities. We see education is very highly correlated with happiness, both because it leads to higher income and for independent reasons. There seems to be a strong relationship between education and happiness, and that's certainly a public policy issue.
I mean, that makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, if people that, if you know things, you're curious about the world, you can master information, facts, whatever, that would lead to some kind of self-satisfaction or satisfaction.
Absolutely. And I've tried this introspective idea. Why is it that as someone who's living in this wonderfully wealthy country, I feel so happy? Economists aren't very good at introspection. But, you know, maybe it is those moments of peace when you just get to sit and think. And maybe the fact that, you know, I earn a nice income gives me the freedom sometimes to sit and be free from worry. Maybe it's the fact that this morning was a beautiful day and I got to walk in here to your studio this morning and enjoy the sun rather than having to wake up at 8 a.m. and go straight to the factory gate. And so it may not be the extra iPod that the income bought me that's making me happy, but this broader lifestyle and sense of choice, sense of purpose as well. I've gotten to choose an occupation that I really happen to believe in. I get to teach. I get to do economic research. What a luxury.
And it makes you happy.
You bet.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with our guests. That's Justin Wolvers. He's Associate Professor of Business and Public Policy at Wharton. Betsy Stevenson with us, Assistant Professor of Business and Public Policy at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Both of them joining us today in Radio Times to talk about some of their research, which looks at economics and happiness. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Act Two Playhouse supports WHYY, a 130-seat theater located in Ambler. Act Two presents Stones in His Pockets. This comedy chronicles the making of a big-budget Hollywood movie in a provincial Irish village. In this fast-paced production, two actors play an entire cast of eccentric characters. Starring Tony Braithwaite and Declan Mooney, Stones in His Pockets, September 2nd through 27th at Act Two Playhouse. Tickets at act2.org, act2.org.
Republicans toned down the politics at today's opening of their national convention in St. Paul due to concerns about damage from Hurricane Gustav in the Gulf Coast. Party presidential nominee John McCain is reportedly considering making his acceptance speech Thursday night, not from the convention podium, but via satellite from the Gulf Coast region. Scheduled speeches tonight by President Bush and Vice President Cheney have been canceled. Stay with WHYY for the latest on the storm. We anticipate resuming convention coverage tomorrow night.
General David Petraeus has been cast in the presidential campaign as a sort of oracle that must be consulted by both candidates when considering the future of Iraq. So writes journalist Steve Cole. Cole profiles Petraeus in an article titled "The Formula, General Petraeus and the Way Out of Iraq," published in this week's New Yorker. We'll talk with Cole on the next Fresh Air.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about whether money can bring you happiness with our guests, both of them working at University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School in their Departments of Business and Public Policy, Betsy Stevenson and Justin Wolvers. And we've got calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me throw some other research that you did. I'm going to toss this back to you, Betsy Stevenson. This was a study called The Paradox of Declining Female Happiness, looking at something like 35 years of economic and educational progress, of women, having to do with the women's movement and going to school and getting jobs and helping to support the family, blah, 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 blah. That did not result, according to your research, in increased happiness for women. Now, how do you explain this based on what we just were talking about?
Right. Well, we've already discussed the fact that the U.S. is a bit of a puzzle when we realize that the U.S. hasn't gotten happier since the 1970s. And the reason, one important reason the U.S. hasn't gotten happier is because the women in the United States have gotten less happy. So the men have actually gotten, you know, a little bit happier, but that's been completely countered by the fact that the women have gotten less happy. So women have gotten less happy absolutely and relative to men. And we turned around and we looked at other countries to see if this was happening in other countries, and it is.
Really?
Now, we've already said most other countries, people have been getting happier, and in most other countries, women have been getting happier, but the men have been outpacing them in the happiness gains. So here we've experienced this time where, you know, really opportunities have been shifting towards women, and everything I've previously said, you would expect them to have gotten happier.
Exactly.
And I think it's a real puzzle why they haven't. And we don't really have a good answer for why women have gotten less happy.
Well, and because what I mean, your thesis that we were talking about originally was that when people make more money, and if you have more education, you're going to get more money, and with more education, you're going to be more satisfied, you're going to be happier. So this is a paradox, the fact that women in the United States, and as you say, in some other countries, with all this progress, haven't felt happier.
Yeah. Anytime an academic calls their research a paradox, you know it's because they don't really know what's going on.
They don't understand what's going on.
And there's no shortage of theories here. Lots of women have told us about, you know, all that I got was to work the second shift. I get to work in both the home and in the marketplace now. Boy, my husband really gained.
And that's why we have all these happy husbands, right?
Well, that could be part of it, except for the fact that it's the declining female happiness has happened as much for single women as married women. It's happened as much for mothers as for non-mothers. That's really puzzling. Mm. This is something that's as true for 17-year-old girls as it is for middle-aged women. And so once you start to think about that, it becomes a lot harder to believe that theory. A different theory says maybe the puzzle isn't why women are so unhappy today, but why were they so darn happy back in the early 70s?
That feels like cheating to me, but nonetheless. Because if you were really happy back then and you're not now, then... Then
your happiness has declined.
Right. I mean, which raises questions about whether women should go back home and raise the children and never think about a career.
They could have been super happy in the 70s because they thought, my goodness, the revolution has come and I'm going to have equality and my daughters are going to grow up and be in a world where it's not going to matter that whether they're a girl or a boy, all people will be treated equal regardless of gender. Boy, that vision, it's a little disappointing, right? We haven't quite hit that. And so that could explain why people aren't as happy as when they really thought that was going to happen, as they've looked around and found that it's been harder to achieve gender equality than I think anybody envisioned in the 70s. It's not surprising that that's a little bit disappointing.
Let me get a little deeper in the numbers, then we'll get to our callers. I'll put this to you, Justin Wolvers. As you said, Americans are not happier than they were in the 1970s as a whole. Can you kind of take apart some of the research about within groups or between groups, you know, who has gained, who has lost?
Yeah, so it's a combination of good and bad news. One of the biggest things that's happened to the income distribution is highly educated folks have gotten a lot richer, and high school dropouts have really suffered over the last 30 years economically. The happiness data parallels that. Highly educated folks, in fact, college graduates, their happiness is rising. High school dropouts are becoming substantially less happy. You see, I think, something closer to good news when you look at race. The happiness gap between African Americans and whites was at unconscionably high levels 30 years ago, and we've actually managed to reduce that by about two-thirds. Mm. It's not quite equal yet, but it's a remarkable indicator of how far we've come, and I think a lot of that happiness gap has disappeared even faster than the income gaps have, suggesting that, you know, the real some of the real sting of racism, you know, it's beyond income. It's also simply how one's treated, and a lot of that seems to be disappearing.
So on the one hand, we've got this wide gap between rich and poor people when it comes to happiness. But then you've got within some of these subset groups more consensus, I guess, or more equality when it comes to happiness.
Definitely on the racial dimension, yes, right. And actually on the gender thing, women used to be happier than men, and so the fact that women have become less happy through time, believe it or not, is a force for equality of happiness.
Easy for you to say. Yeah. You want to add to that, Betsy?
Well, a lot of people have pointed to this and said that this is equality. Women have now become less happy. I think one explanation that we haven't got to is simply whether women were lying early in the earlier surveys. I think women were under a lot of pressure to exaggerate their well-being, to not complain. Right. And one of the things the women's movement had gave women was the right to stand up and shout their misery to the world. And that might be what we're picking up in the data. And in fact, I think that explanation is really one of the ones that's best matched by the data, because we see women getting less happy relative to men in all sorts of countries that have had much more equality than the United States and countries that have much less equality than the United States. But this sort of movement to have a voice, I think, has been international, and would explain why we have such an international movement in happiness.
The right to complain,
right,
in a sense, about what has happened. But does that also raise questions that just about surveys? I mean, if the work is dependent on surveys are subjective, they're, you know, tied to a certain time and culture and place, and when you're trying to tease all this stuff apart, you know, you're dependent on what people say about themselves.
Absolutely. Now, I should add, all economic data comes from surveys. You know, the way we measure the unemployment rate is we stop people and we ask them whether they have a job or not, and if they're unemployed, if they don't have a job, we ask them whether they want one. That's a survey question.
Right.
The way we measure GDP is we call factories and we ask them how much their profits are. Again, that's a survey question. But I do think this paradox that women have become less happy does raise real questions. If you think that the idea that the women's movement, if you're absolutely convinced that the women's movement was good for women, and many people I know are, and you have a measurement technology that says that it wasn't, then the right inference is the measurement technology is broken, which is to say we shouldn't believe happiness studies. And I think that's a perfectly acceptable hypothesis here. It's certainly not something we can falsify.
But do happy people, I mean, this is, I don't know if this is beyond your pay grade or not, but the happy people, happy countries, I mean, do they behave differently than poor people and poor countries, or unhappy people and unhappy countries?
Absolutely. So there's lots of work that does validate these happiness measures. For instance, we told you that rich countries are happier than poor countries. People in rich countries also report smiling more often or laughing more often. They report feeling pain less often. They report depression less often. They report being bored less often. They report being respected at work. They report being able to choose. So all of these things are a little bit less fuzzy than just asking people about their happiness, but they do seem to be highly correlated. With the gender thing, the issue there is slightly different, which is it could be that, you know, there was just something that changed in how women reported on the surveys, and that can always confuse your inferences.
Go ahead, Betsy. I want to add that we don't even know that this is something about the women's movement at all. It could be something completely different. There's been a lot of social changes over the last 30, 40 years. And those social changes, even though they affect men and women equally in some sense, they may affect them unequally in how they respond to them or how they think about them. So, you know, people have become more responsible for their own financial lives in terms of saving for retirement, in terms of managing their health care and health insurance. These things might be more upsetting or difficult for women to handle than for men. There's been a movement, you know, people are spreading out all over the United States, disconnected families. Again, these might affect women differently than men. We don't know. And there's no there's nothing that tells us that it's the women's movement that's had this effect on women. It could be any of these other social changes.
We had a caller want to know, what is GDP? I'm going to have you define that. I'll reintroduce you, then we'll get to our callers. Go ahead, Betsy.
GDP is our gross domestic product. And the best way to think about GDP per capita is just to think about our average income.
So if you average everybody's income, and but it does have to do with how much what spending a country does. The GDP is based on total spending?
One person's spending is another person's income. And so the sum of all income in an economy is equal to the sum of all spending in an economy, and we call both of those things GDP.
Fair enough. And that's Justin Wolvers. He's Associate Professor of Business and Public Policy at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Betsy Stevenson, Assistant Professor of Business and Public Policy, also at Wharton. And they both join us today in Radio Times to talk about some of their interesting research having to do with money and happiness. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Francis from Wilmington to join us this morning on Radio Times. Hi, Francis. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
I was thinking that maybe the pursuing happiness might be the wrong direction, that what we need to do is pursue peace and serenity.
And I guess the question is whether there's a connection between the two?
I don't think there is a connection between the two. I think happiness is totally different than having peace and serenity.
And from your perspective, what is peace and serenity?
The innermost feeling that I'm connected to the things around me, to the earth, just the totally different than the happiness feeling that comes from my head, I guess.
Well, let's find out. I mean, this happiness is subjective in certain kinds of ways. I'm going to toss this to you, Betsy Stevenson.
I completely agree with the caller that we want to think about what happiness is, our peace and serenity. I actually, somebody asked me, you know, in doing this research, people have asked me, they say, well, are you happy? Are you satisfied with your life? And I've said, well, I'm very satisfied with my life, but I don't have time right now to be happy. And so I think that happiness has a lot to do with peace and serenity. And so my idea of happiness would be going to yoga 3 times a week and having time to meditate and really reflect on my life. And I think that's what would make me happy. So I don't think that they're necessarily as orthogonal as the caller might have suggested.
Justin, you want to add to that?
I was just going to say, we have examined a lot of measures of sort of affect, and I described already, you know, things like do you feel depressed and so on. Mm-hmm. One thing that appears not to be well related to income is, did you feel love a lot yesterday? It turns out that feelings of love are about as common in rich countries as poor countries.
But you're saying, picking up on that doesn't necessarily translate or correlate into happiness or this happiness economics.
Yeah. The short version would be income buys you happiness, but it can't buy you love.
I think I've heard that before. Let me get Leslie from Center City, Philadelphia, to join us. Hi, Leslie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm wondering whether wealth or richness is not so much something that should be considered, but rather things like access and distribution. In certain countries, for instance, and this also goes into the question as to whether why women are less happy. Even in, let's say, countries of Scandinavia, for instance, where, let's say, 45% of the legislature is feminine, they probably have a happiness factor because it's a more integrated society. Well, in this society, although women have hit a glass ceiling, there really still is not equality, even as much as there is with the racial civil rights movement, because it didn't go as far in really releasing women into the society as a whole. So I'm wondering whether the question is more the overall access, distribution of wealth, and wealth meaning positions of power, your agenda, being considered, as it is not with women most of the time, in governmental factors.
You know what, Leslie, let me take the first part, because I had some questions about distribution and some of these Scandinavian countries. I'll put this to you, Justin, which is, as you said, one of the Scandinavian countries had a higher quotient of happiness. But looking at them in total, you know, they do distribute their money more equitably, I would say, than in the United States and some other countries.
Absolutely. So the key finding actually is that raising anyone's income by 10% has about the same effect on their happiness.
Rich or poor.
Yeah. And so raising the income of a poor person by 10% costs a whole heck of a lot less than raising the income of a rich person by 10%, in which case, taking some money from the rich and giving to the poor,
right,
you might imagine would raise average happiness. So I think there's every reason to suspect that those sorts of issues matter. Now, Leslie's thinking about comparing, for instance, the US with Denmark. The most overwhelming comparison when you just think about people's opportunities in the world is comparing the US to Burundi. And the opportunities that Danes or Americans have relative to those in Burundi are just so many orders of magnitude bigger that when we make those comparisons, the US is overwhelmingly happier. And that's the most that's the thing that just leaps out at you from the data. So our higher GDP, I'm sure that our higher incomes, I'm sure we can do a better job of distributing it.
Right.
But with greater income comes greater opportunities.
I wonder, too, let me throw something else in here, Betsy, having to do with, I'm not sure everyone in Burundi has access to the internet or television, but nonetheless, it's possible to know how other people in the world live, I mean, more and more, and whether that creates a sense of sort of relative unhappiness when you look at your life and you compare it to someone else who's better off.
Right. Well, that actually gets right at the heart of this debate of the Easterlin paradox, which is that the Easterlin paradox, as Justin stated early, said that, you know, rich people within a country are happier than poor people, but we don't see that kind of relationship across countries. What we now see is very clearly that the same kind of relationship, the same magnitude of relationship that we see within countries, we see across countries. Now, this begs the question, though, right, of whether or not the world has just become so integrated that my relative comparison group isn't my neighborhood or even my country, but it's the world. It's how wealthy I could be in the world. And I think that question's very hard to answer, although what we do see in that what we'd really want is to be able to go back in time and have really good survey questions, right, back when people didn't know what the rest of the world was like. But what we can do is look at countries where there's less access to television, and we don't seem to see any real difference based on how much access to television you have, where you sit in this relationship. And we of course also see that countries are getting happier over time as they get richer, and that is direct evidence against this idea that it's just relative comparisons around the world. So the fact that we see Japan's income grew enormously in the post-world period, mm-hmm, and we saw the Japanese get much happier, and that can't be about relative comparison.
And we're almost about a break here, but I mean, looking at China, I would assume that would be a country people like you would want to look at, because we're watching this exploding economy in China.
China's going to be very interesting. The difficulty for social scientists is we just don't have good surveyors in the field, and there's also two Chinas. There's rapid development in the cities and almost no development in rural China. And so that would be a wonderful experiment for us to go in and analyze. And we're waiting for more data to become available.
Let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We're talking with Justin Wolvers and Betsy Stevenson. Both of them have published interesting papers having to do with economic happiness. In their newly published paper, they found that rich people are, yes, happier than poor people. Rich countries are happier than poor countries. And as countries get richer, their citizens tend to get happier. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
PCAH supports WHYY and, in partnership with MegaWorks, presents a month-long art exhibition and project space this September. This globally distributed Philadelphia-based magazine focused on beauty and culture will come to life, showcasing permanent and rotating installations, guest speakers, musical performances, workshops, and film screenings, all open to the public. A schedule of events and full details are online at megawordsmagazine.com.
If you listen to Radio Times on 91 FM, why not check out the TV version of the program? I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, and Friday at 8 on TV 12, it's Radio Times on TV. You can see what you heard on 91 FM, or if you missed the radio show, you can catch up by watching the TV version. That's Radio Times on TV, Friday at 8 on WHYY TV 12.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's daytime news magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up, plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture, Here and Now. Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Betsy Stevenson and Justin Wolvers today on the show and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Betsy, you said something during the break, but I want you to say it on the air for our listeners, because during the break, we were just trying to sort of reconfigure a couple of things. And again, I want to make sure people understand what we're talking about. But give that example, and then we'll get to our callers.
So we've talked about how happiness, the relationship between happiness and income can really be thought of as the relationship between happiness and our opportunities for how we're going to spend our day. And one of the things we see when we look across countries is a strong relationship between GDP per capita and people saying they got to choose how they spent their day, and people saying that they felt respected during their day. And this makes sense, because the more opportunities you have, the more capabilities you have, the better able you are to walk away from a situation where somebody's not treating you with respect. And that ability to walk away to make that choice is going to make you happier.
Well, and I mean, that gets the standard of living, right? I mean, as people's standards of living increase, they get more choices, hopefully, more opportunities. I'm looking at you, Justin, then we'll get to our callers.
Absolutely. In France, Sarkozy has recently convened a panel of economists to have a broader look at how to measure the standard of living. The cynic would say, Sarkozy is worried because France doesn't come first, and this panel of economists has to find a metric in which France does come first. But, you know, the French go on vacation more often than we do, and I think many of us don't feel we have that opportunity, in which case maybe these sorts of measures that take account of things beyond just our income can do a better job at mapping to the things we really care about, like our happiness.
Since we're on the throes of a presidential election, I mean, if you had a candidate or even the next president who took this information, this research that you've been doing, how would that translate into some kind of a policy?
I think one of the things that comes out of this is that maximizing average incomes, which is to say GDP or economic growth, can be a useful thing to do, but one wants to make sure that all the gains don't go to those who already have all the wealth. And so I think there, you know, the distribution of income is going to be a really important thing. If a 10% rise in income buys the same bump in happiness for the poor as for the rich, it does suggest that the really cheap way of making Americans happier on average is going to be to help the poor out.
Anything you want to add to that, Betsy?
I think that policy needs to think about making sure people have options and opportunities. And one of the great things about the American economy is it's a very flexible economy. And that's what's made us rich. And I think that's also what's made us happy, that people can make choices. They can change careers. They can be failing in high school and pull themselves together and emerge a college graduate. People have a lot of opportunities to reinvent themselves. And that makes us rich and it makes us happy. And we need to make sure people continue to have those opportunities to reinvent themselves.
Let me get Joey from Makunji to join us. Hi, Joey. Go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I actually have a question, or actually maybe some comments first. In my line of work, I have traveled quite a bit throughout the world. In fact, I've actually lived abroad. Lived in Australia for a little over a year, and also lived in Canada, and have traveled to Scandinavia quite a bit and spent some time there in the summer times, you know, during vacation times. And one of the most common questions that I would always get hit with, you know, is, is it better here or is it better over there?
Right.
You know, one of the factors that I've sort of come across, and I actually want to pose this question to the guest, is how much has climate played a role in the determining of, you know, level of happiness? From what I've seen and what I've observed anyway, is that those who have opportunities to go on vacation or to, you know, to broaden their horizons and actually compare themselves or their own personal successes and you know, personal richness, as you would define it, by traveling and seeing other parts of the world, have a lot more of a basis to go by.
Sure.
But,
well, you know, let me take your point about climate, and I actually looked to our Aussie here, Justin Wolvers, to get your response. Thanks, Joey, for the call.
I'm just going to hang up.
Okay, fair enough. Right. No, I appreciate you calling in. Go ahead,
Joey. It's an interesting question. It turns out most of us believe that climate has a really big effect. If you ask most Americans if Californians are happier than you are, we all think they are. It turns out when you go and ask Californians how happy they are, they're no happier than the rest of us. Let me just give a very simple comparison. Two of the happiest countries in the world are Australia, my country, beautiful sunshine, beautiful beaches, all that stuff, and Iceland. And I can't think of a more miserable place on Earth. So it's got to be that the climate's just not the factor that you and I seem to think it is. I do think that's puzzling.
Yep. Another one of these puzzles, right?
You bet.
Joey, thanks for the call. Let me get, is that Friday calling us from Lawton? Friday, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Yes, how you doing?
Good.
My question, it's not really a question, it's a comment. Since happiness is a subjective and abstract issue, how can you measure a nation's happiness the same way you measure individuals' happiness? I'm wondering how you can do that.
It's a very good question, and we've been wrestling with this definition of happiness. I'm going to toss that to you, Betsy. Freddie, thanks for the call.
So when we talk about a nation's happiness, what we're really doing is just aggregating up the happiness of all the individuals in the nation. And so that's back to how we've previously answered the question, which is we just go out and ask people, surveys go out and ask people how happy they are, how satisfied they are with their life. And when we want to take this to the national level, we want to just take all of those individuals and essentially add up the happiness of each individual till we get a national measure of happiness,
sort of a GDP of happiness. Then
exactly.
You sort of add it all together and put it in a big box.
We'll call it gross national happiness.
Gross national happiness, GDH. But can you say that, you know, Bill Gates? I'm thinking of all the, you know, the rich people in the world. Is he happier than you and me?
I'd say
he's got more money.
I'd say it's pretty likely.
But do we know that?
No, I mean, Bill and I would have to sit down and have a beer together, and we could actually attach electrodes to each of our brains and measure some types of brain activity. But that direct comparison is going to be very difficult. But I bet that you and I could sit down and have a conversation and decide which of us was happier.
Right.
The fact that something's abstract or subjective doesn't mean it can't be measured or that it shouldn't be taken seriously in policy discussions.
And not to belabor this, but we talked about it, but you and I could also have different definitions of happiness. So I could say I'm happier than you, but my criteria might be different from you.
Absolutely. And I don't care if your criteria is whatever it is. If you're happier than I am, then you're doing a better job than I am.
But am I making more money than you?
That's
we don't know the answer to that.
These fancy studios here, Marty, it looks like you might be.
Anything you want to add to that, Betsy?
You know, I agree with Justin that we don't want to say, boy, subjective things are hard, let's not measure them. We do the best we can to measure them. And then what we want to do is see if our measures of these subjective things are correlated with objective measures. And that was why we also looked at these things like indicators of pain or eating good-tasting food. You know, it turns out that as countries get wealthier, more and more people say they ate good-tasting food. That's again, I guess it's subjective, but, you know, of course that's something that goes into, I would think, a good day, having good food. And it turns out that as you get wealthier, it's easier for every meal to be full of good food.
Because you can afford to have this good-tasting food or perhaps test yourself.
And make choices over what you want to eat, right? And so, it all comes down to what our options are, what our opportunities are, and then our ability to make choices over those opportunities.
You want to add to that, Justin?
I'm all done, man.
Okay, that's all right. Let me get to Frank from the Northeast to join us. Hi, Frank. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
Well, thank you, Marty. Thank you for this program.
You're
welcome. I love this program.
Great.
Listen, I'd rather look at this issue as fulfillment rather than happiness. Because to me, being fulfilled is having my expectation match my reality. So if I expect to go to work and get paid for what I do, and I get that payment, I feel fulfilled.
Right.
I mean, you know, to me, happiness is, oh, you're giddy, you're laughing, you're giggling all over the place. You know, I come from a church where we look at joy or fulfillment, if you will, rather than happiness, you know?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and because, as you know, people have different definitions of what we're talking about. But let me get our guest, Justin Wolfers, to respond to your comments. Frank, appreciate the call to Radio Times.
So, Frank, one of the ways that we measure what I'm calling happiness, and I shouldn't use the shorthand, is instead a different question when we ask people to imagine the ladder of life. And on the ladder of life, the top rung is the most satisfying life you could imagine, and the bottom rung is the least satisfying life you can imagine. And where do you place yourself on that ladder? So that, I think, is a little closer to the concept that you're thinking about. And it turns out answers to that question are very similar to answers when you simply ask people how happy they are. The other part of what Frank said that's so interesting is Frank suggested that satisfaction comes from reality matching your expectations.
Yeah, I like that.
It might be right, but by jingo, doesn't it suggest the easiest way in the world to get happy? Just have the lowest possible expectations? And then we could come back to, well, how do we solve the paradox of why women have become so unhappy? Maybe what we need to do is go out and lower their expectations. I'm not sure I want to suggest that as a policy.
You want to add to that? I mean, it's an interesting, another sort of monkey wrench into the discussion.
Well, I think that there's two ways to think about, you know, expectations. So Justin suggests this way where, well, now let's just lower our expectations and then we'll be happier. I think that in some sense we all do have an expectation of how our life's going to go, and that expectation is actually based on the information that we have. And when we get a positive shock to that information, we get happier. And when we get a negative shock to that information, we get less happy. And that shouldn't be surprising, right? So if I'm going along and then I get a diagnosis of cancer, that's a negative shock, sure. And I'm probably going to be less happy. If I'm going along and all of a sudden I get a massive promotion that I never expected, then I should be a lot happier. And this also explains why we really shouldn't expect people to get happier as they get their little tiny annual raises, because they do expect them, because they know they're working hard, and in the career they're in, there's a certain path, and they expect to be on that path. So of course they shouldn't be getting happier as they march down the path they expect. What we want to see is that there's changes in their happiness when there's real changes in news. Something happens. You know, you go from the city council to a vice presidential candidate in a very short period of time. It's a real shock.
And maybe one happy person in this country. Let me get to Alan from Delco to join us. Hi, Alan. Go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Hi, thank you. Well, maybe I'm throwing another monkey wrench in.
Go ahead.
Mostly
we like
in this conversation,
wrenches.
We've been talking about the correlation between happiness and income, and occasionally talking about how higher income causes more happiness. But if it's really just a correlation, doesn't it make as much sense to say that happier people are more successful economically, happier people make more money? And I can think of a narrative to support that. You know, happier people don't throw their money away gambling, maybe, or don't get divorced as often, or lead to other economic disasters.
No, I think it's a fair point. Who should I toss that to? Should I toss that to you, Betsy? Go ahead.
Sure. So I think that is a fair point, and we're not trying to necessarily say which way the correlation goes. I mean, it's interesting that you brought up the point of divorce, because, you know, it's long been mentioned that divorced people have a whole set of negative characteristics. Divorced people are more likely to be alcoholics. Divorced people are more likely to be unemployed. But of course, similarly, we think that those things might have caused the divorce in the first place. And it's the same thing financially. We see that divorced people have less money, but we also see that the type of people who have less money are more likely to get divorced.
Right.
So, you know, I want to acknowledge that it is very difficult for us to sort out these causal roadways, but it's also not clear from the type of evidence that was just cited that we should think that happiness goes the other way, that by being happy we get rich.
Yeah, and you want to add to that? Because, I mean, taking Alan's point and the examples he gave, one could make an argument that if you're happy and satisfied, you see opportunity maybe where other people don't, that there are certain characteristics that might allow you to be more financially successful.
Absolutely. Correlation is not causation, wow. But it depends on the facts we're thinking about. Let's think across countries. America is Americans on average are much happier than people in Burundi. Do we think that it's that America's high happiness is what's causing us to be much, much richer than those in Burundi? Or do we think that it's America's riches that is causing us to be much happier? I think there it's pretty clear it's not a reverse causation channel. Now, it could be that some of the things that make America rich, things like having a vibrant democracy, those things raise both happiness and income. Absolutely. And so having now established the correlations, it's now up to the rest of us to try and sort out exactly how it is that income and happiness are linked. But we know they're linked.
Hmm. And since you mentioned democracy, are people happier in democracies than they are in dictatorships, for instance?
Absolutely. But by same token, dictatorships are usually in very poor countries.
That's true. Just to add to that. So I'm curious, we have about a minute before we have to say goodbye. What got you interested in this happiness question as an economist, Betsy?
Well, I think that, you know, it really is important for us to understand the value of economic growth to people's lives. And, you know, that there's sort of a basic economic assumption that economic growth is a good thing. And, it's really important that we actually know the answer to that. And that's why we wanted to go back to this question, is just to answer the basics. And I think the answer to this question also helps us understand maybe what the limitations are to what we can learn from these subjective well-being questions. I certainly look at the evidence on women getting less happy and say, maybe this is the limit to what we can learn when we're trying to look over time at subjective well-being. I don't know very many women who wish we could go back to 1970.
Nonetheless, that research sort of hangs out there as that paradox. Well, I thank you both for joining us today in Radio Times. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Manny.
You're
welcome.
Thank you.
Betsy Stevenson, Assistant Professor of Business and Public Policy at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Justin Wolvers is Associate Professor of Business and Public Policy, also at Wharton, joining us today on Radio Times to talk about their research on happiness and the economy, GDP. That's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program, including things like podcasts. Scotty Williams, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Patty Leswing is the producer of Radio Times. Susan Greenbaum and Devorah Lissick are senior producers of Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.